Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Jill Kaufman.
This summer, after months of witnessing how race continued to divide, communities in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and so many other places, the writer Jabari Asim said in the New York Times, "The sooner my children and grandchildren, all African American, can learn about what it means to be black in a society still riven by racist attitudes and the uneven application of justice, the better equipped they'll be to navigate it."
With Jabari Asim, a creative writing professor at Emerson College and the editor of the NAACP's magazine, The Crisis, his family will likely learn about life through literature and film and reality. And then there's also his new novel called Only the Strong. It takes place in a fictional Midwestern location called Gateway City. It could be St. Louis, where Jabari grew up. It's a 1970s post-Martin Luther King assassination moment, a time that was filled with sweeping social and political change, that is. And Jabari Asim joins us now in the studio. Welcome, and very nice to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
What do you call your novel, your debut novel, but not your first published piece, Only the Strong? It's an American novel, you call it. Why?
Well, because publishing is as segregated as any other aspect of our society. And if African-American writers don't insist upon their inclusion in this larger American conversation, we find ourselves marginalized even in cultural discussions, even in, say, on bookstore shelves. There's African-American interest, of ethnic interest. And so there's this sort of implication that we are not part of the mainstream.
So this is as opposed to an African-American novel.
Exactly. Right. I mean, the characters happen to be African-American, but obviously the other half of that hyphen is American, and they are very much a part of the fabric of this country.
I had a similar conversation about this with a whole other genre of writers, women and men who wrote gay fiction and lesbian fiction and transgender fiction. And I said, okay, at what point do you get to get just on the shelf, you know? And
right.
do you want that too? So there's more to talk about on that. But I wonder if you'd tell us about the people, the men and the women who are in this black Midwestern America, 1970s. Lorenzo Guts Tulliver is the most prominent character, but
sure,
there's a huge ensemble of people you write about. And after reading, I feel very much like I'm going to miss them. we spend time in their lives. So talk about what this is about.
Well, it's like you say, it's about this moment post Martin Luther King assassination. And my earlier book, A Taste of Honey, explores this same community in the 1960s. And one of the characters in that book was Lorenzo Guts Tulliver. And he has a moment right after the assassination of Martin Luther King in which he figures in a story, but he has no lines in that story. And even as I was writing it, I was curious, well, what is Guts Tulliver thinking at this moment, and how does it affect him? So Only the Strong sort of begins there and expands out to other characters in the community.
How long ago did you write that short story?
Let's see. A Taste of Honey came out in 2010.
So that's 5 years ago, and a lot of change now in race in America. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, so I go from Guts Tulliver. There are other characters. There's Dr. Artensis Noel is a primary character. She's having a long, tempestuous affair with the local crime boss for whom Guts works. His name is Ananias Good. And finally, the last character that I focus on is named Charlotte Devine, and she's a headstrong college student who's finding her way in this rapidly changing cultural landscape.
Mm-hmm. She is also the adopted, or at least casually adopted, daughter,
sure,
of the doctor.
Yes.
And all these people interact. And then there's all these male characters who are part of this alleged taxi cab company.
Yes.
There's a lot going on there every day. And a lot of dialogue, which is really quite rich as well. And I found myself laughing at times when I think there were serious moments. But, I mean, the Philistine moment, which I don't want to give away. see, it's such a good line. I'm going to.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. It's such a good line. So maybe we'll get to that later, too. I wonder if now might be a really good time for you to take out a passage and just read so people can hear what it is we're talking about. And we're going to get to the relevance of who you are and what this means now. But let's stay with the book for a moment. Go ahead.
Sure. This is a moment involving Dr. Artensis Noel, who's from a small southern town called Honey Springs and now lives in Gateway City. She'd sworn off the world of cotton and cucumbers, confident she'd soon be setting foot in a hot field for the last time. Back then, she thought she might eventually settle in Honey Springs after exploring distant shores. But when she came back to bury her mother, she knew she'd been kidding herself. Every family struggling in every shack had suffered some version of her loss. The ground, spongy beneath her feet, was soaked with sorrow. Sadness hummed through the air louder than honeybees. Only by leaving and returning was she able to fully appreciate how pervasive it was. Each tree stump, hollow log, and bend in the road was a reminder of the long gone and the freshly killed, the broken and the missing. Watching the people of North Gateway promenade and cavort on the green grass of Fairgrounds Park, Hortensis allowed herself to briefly savor the joyful spirit of the day. They had fled the same history, known the same ruptures and defeats, but there was something daring and admirable about their willingness to take a chance on joy, even if only for a few sun-splashed hours.
There is this divide between happiness and violence between for these men and women in your stories, between, you know, seeking out something, and yet there's always a struggle that's pervasive there. If she were to look around Gateway City today, would she be seeing the same thing? What would she see?
Very much so. I mean, I think that's one of the most distressing things about the community that I've fictionalized here in this book, how much things have not changed.
I mean, is this your St. Louis? Is this where you grew up?
Yes, that's where I grew up. And A Taste of Honey begins with the police killing of an unarmed black man, and it's set in 1967. So, you know, Mike Brown is so many decades later, but it's sort of the same cultural moment, once again, where people are painfully politically awakened as a result of the reality they find themselves in.
So, you know, so you've jumped now decades, right? But things, are you saying that things have not really changed? I mean, this is this book written shortly after, a few years after Martin Luther King's death, and now here we are where there's no more segregation by the books, but there's still an incredible divide.
Yeah, I mean, there's still quite a bit of segregation in St. Louis. Most studies you know, by any measure, St. Louis is a particularly segregated city. But what we found is the North Side community where these characters live, the surrounding suburbs opened up to them in the decades following the death of Martin Luther King. So a lot of people were able to move, but they found themselves in communities like Ferguson and Jennings and North County communities that sit right outside of the North Side community that I fictionalize here. And a lot of the problems, and especially the aggressive policing, came with them.
You know, I want to ask you about your own experience as a black man in America, not only in St. Louis, but here on the East Coast. And something happened to you that you wrote about for WBUR, and I'm sure elsewhere, where you you live in a suburb, you live in Newton. You had an incident that you were accused of having a traffic violation that you were not even, you say, a part of. Can you just tell us what happened?
Yes, I received a citation in the mail that accused me of driving without a license at a particular intersection in Newton at a particular time and place. The citation specifically identified me as a black male, and I knew I'd been at work at that particular time and hadn't been behind the wheel of a car at all that day. So I went to the police station and asked the officer, "Are you sure it was me? Are you sure you saw me?" And he insisted it was me. And the incident report says, "I first caught his attention, allegedly, by behaving nervously behind the wheel of a car." I'm not quite sure what that is. I'm hopeful we'll find out in court. I'm looking forward to
when
my
date
in court. September 8th.
So this has gone that far?
It's gone that far. Mm-hmm. I mean, the incident happened in June, and my lawyer and I have been waiting for a forum ever since.
Mm-hmm. So you've documented through your iPhone movements and through receipts. Your wife had the car that day.
Receipts, and also I have signed affidavits from witnesses who placed me at work and other places.
It's in itself a remarkable story. So let's take that back to what you've written as a novel and who you are as an editor of the NAACP's journal, its magazine. Your own experiences are influencing who you are as a creative writer, of course. How do you then process what you experienced then in here in 2015, where you try to live in with your family, African-American family, in a somewhat mixed neighborhood in Newton? I mean, but it's white.
That's putting it generously.
Okay. Are you choosing
to
live in a white neighborhood? Are you just trying to live in a great place?
I'm choosing to live in a neighborhood that has outstanding schools because I'm a father of five. So all of our decisions in terms of residence are based on, we look at the top 10 school systems when we're moving to a community, and we decide which one we could possibly afford to live in. And then we make our move. We really don't consider any other factors. Parenting comes first.
All right. So this is a hard question for me as a white person to ask, and I'm going to ask it and I'll probably trip on it. But I mean, you're seeking a more integrated life. And when I say integrated, I don't mean the opposite of segregated at all. I just mean that you want to live in a place where you have colleagues and neighbors who are from, and you have good schools, and they may be white and they may be Asian, they may be something else. But is that even possible? And is that possible? And are other Black Americans and other Americans seeking that as well?
I think a lot of people are seeking that. I think that's part of the general American aspiration. But I think what's remarkable to me is that I'm a man in my 50s, and I still spend a lot of my experience as what we call the only. Most of my jobs, I've been the only Black man. When I'm standing in line at the supermarket, I'm the only Black man. There's so many experiences that I have in which I am sort of bound by who I am and expected to represent everyone.
Right. And I don't mean to do that to you
sure,
here.
Yeah.
But you also edit a magazine for the NAACP. And
yes.
you must be touching a lot of different topics and articles and writers. So that is why I'm asking you to sort of explain to me your worldview. Your book, your novel, Only the Strong, is the only white character that I came across and I may have missed was a police officer who was red in the face, right, from being annoyed that Guts almost ran him over because he was daydreaming and listened to a great soundtrack. You know, you have a wonderful soundtrack in this. but you created a beautiful world of Black America, even with its struggle and maybe its unfairness. Does it exist anymore or doesn't? Can this St. Louis, this Gateway City moment be? Can you live in a great Black community and have life the way you want it?
Yeah, I think those pockets still exist, but they're much smaller than they used to be. And I would just add that even though I grew up in an all-Black neighborhood, I always went to all-white schools on the other side of town. So I always sort of had a foot in both worlds coming up.
What kind of response have you been getting to both what you've written in this novel and how that merges with what your own experience had been here in the Boston area recently? I mean, I read some pretty awful things after the WBUR piece aired. You can read anything. All these are comments written by listeners and people who just happen to read you. Are you surprised by reaction? Let's start with, your own experience in Newton. And how people are responding to you as a professor and comparing you to Cornell,
Henry Louis Gates.
Thank you, to Henry Louis Gates and going from there in the Obama moment and the beer.
Yeah, I think that, I would be extremely hesitant to base any assessment of any communities or Bostonians in general upon what I find in the comments of a media site. I think we're often talking about the fringe, the extreme fringe.
I hope we are.
Yes.
I really hope
and,
we are.
And not representative of the people whom I interact with on a daily basis. So I wouldn't characterize Boston as different in any significant way from any other community in which I've lived.
And assuming that these folks are on the edge, there's still a lot that is wrong about how people communicate about race, which I'm sure that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. When in your book, in your novel, there's a great sense of loyalty and camaraderie among characters. I think it's giving a beautiful portrait of people's lives that can be maybe something that's I hate the phrase teachable moment, but we so often just hear about the negatives that are going on right now in the news about Black American life, and this is gorgeous. Even though these are some of these are very violent folks you kind of become charmed by because they're seeking some kind of forgiveness or redemption, like any of us are. What about the portrait of these people, these men and women? Is it pretty close to truth of the 1970s, of the people you knew?
Yeah, very much inspired by and influenced by people that I had the opportunity to witness and interact growing up. I mean, I think they are complex and ambiguous people, which makes them fully human. And that's sort of my mission as a writer, to represent people like me as fully human and not the products of others' imaginations. And I think that you know, who controls the narrative sort of controls the shape of reality. And as an African-American writer, I want to help take control of that narrative.
Power is in that pen, right?
Yes.
It is. There's so much more that you write. There's children's books. We'd love to have you come back on again and talk about what you're seeing through the NAACP work that you're doing as well, like what you're hearing about the world around you. Thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jabari Asim is a professor of creative writing at Emerson College, my alma mater, and the executive editor of the NAACP's magazine, The Crisis. He's also the author of the new novel, Only the Strong, which you can find a link to on our website, Radio Boston. Jabari Asim, thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.